Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So imagine a disease that is 100% fatal.
Right. It's a terrifying thought.
Yeah, it progresses incredibly rapidly. It attacks the brain, stealing memories, movement, and then ultimately life itself. And the truly chilling part, it isn't caused by a virus. It's not a bacteria. It is caused by a rogue, misfolded protein, a prion.
Which completely defies how we usually think about infectious diseases.
Exactly. And for decades, scientists have been completely unable to grow the human version of these rogue proteins in a standard laboratory dish. Like, we have been essentially flying blind, and that has totally bottlenecked our search for a cure.
It really has. It's been a massive roadblock for the whole field.
So as we get into this deep dive, I want you to ask yourself, what really happens when we finally bridge a decades-old gap in neurodegenerative research? And, you know, how could growing human prions in a scalable cell culture completely change our ability to cure them?
It is such a profound question. And the answer really has implications that stretch far beyond just one single disease. Because when we can finally observe the pathogen clearly in a controlled environment, well, we can finally figure out how to dismantle it.
Today we celebrate the work of Akin Nihat, Parineeta Arora, John Collinge, Parmjit S. Jatt, and their international research team, who have advanced our understanding of human prion biology by successfully developing a scalable dividing cell model.
It is just a remarkable achievement. I mean, to truly appreciate what this research team pulled off, we need to understand the specific biological anomaly that we are dealing with here.
Right. So let's lay the groundwork.
Yeah. So the focus of this research is sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, commonly referred to as SCJD. It is the most frequent human prion disease globally.
I mean, frequent in the context of prion diseases, right? But still incredibly rare in the general population.
Oh, absolutely. Very rare. But as we mentioned, it is uniformly fatal.
So what actually makes a normal protein go rogue like this? I think that's the part that's so hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, the mechanism is really what sets prions apart from almost every other pathogen out there. We all naturally produce normal cellular prion proteins in our bodies, particularly, you know, throughout the nervous system and the brain.
Okay.
In the literature, these are designated as PRPC, and they have a specific three-dimensional shape, largely made up of these coiled structures called alpha helices.
Right, so they're normally all coiled up and doing their job.
Exactly. But in SCJD, a spontaneous event triggers this normal protein to misfold. It basically reconfigures into this rigid, flat structure that is dominated by beta sheets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this disease-associated, highly resistant form is known as PRPSC. And the defining characteristic of PRPSC is that it is autocatalytic.
Wait, hold on. Let me make sure I'm picturing this right. Autocatalytic. So it isn't reproducing by making copies of itself.
Yeah.
Using DNA or RNA like a virus would, right?
No, not at all. It doesn't have any genetic material of its own.
So it is physically converting the healthy proteins around it.
That is the absolute core of it. It acts as a physical template. So when a misfolded PRPSC bumps into a healthy, normally folded PRPC, it literally forces that healthy protein to unravel and refold into the rigid, diseased shape.
That is terrifying. So now you have two rogue proteins.
Right. And then those two bump into two more, creating four, then eight. It triggers this catastrophic biological domino effect.
Wow.
The misfolded proteins just clump together into these toxic aggregates, which ultimately leads to massive, irreversible neuronal death.
So the protein itself is the infectious agent. And, you know, looking at the bigger picture here, this specific method of spreading one misfolded protein corrupting others, that mechanism isn't completely isolated to SCJD, is it?
No, it's not. We are increasingly realizing that this mechanistic parallel exists across several major neurodegenerative diseases. We broadly categorize them as proteinopathies.
Right, like Alzheimer's.
Exactly. Alzheimer's disease involves the misfolding and propagation of amyloid and tau proteins. Parkinson's disease is driven by the misfolding of alpha-synuclein.
So they're all kind of following this same rogue template rulebook.
They are. And furthermore, just like these human prions, those other proteins seem to form distinct strains.
Strains, like how viruses have strains.
Sort of, But with proteins, a strain simply means the protein can fold into several different 3D conformations. And depending on the specific shape it takes, it causes entirely different clinical symptoms in the patient.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. So if we can map the fundamental rules of how prion strains propagate, we might unlock the underlying rules of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's as well.
But to map those rules, you need to be able to actually study the proteins up close. And from what I understand, that has been the massive historical roadblock here. I mean, if human cells absolutely refuse to grow these prions in a lab, how on earth do you study them? You can't just force a human cell to cooperate.
Historically, researchers just could not do it. When they attempted to infect standard human cell lines with human prions, the infection would simply, well, it would just die out after a few cell divisions.
Really? It just wouldn't stick?
Yeah. The cells would either clear the misfolded proteins, or they just wouldn't provide the right environment to sustain that domino effect. So to study the disease or to screen potential drugs, scientists were forced to rely on whole animal models, specifically transgenic mice.
And running experiments on a whole living animal is, I mean, that's a completely different universe compared to growing cells in a little plastic dish.
Oh, the logistical and temporal hurdles are just immense. You need highly specialized, prohibitively expensive biosafety containment facilities. You have to maintain colonies of these transgenic mice, you know, carefully managing their genetics and their housing.
That sounds incredibly resource intensive.
It is. And even then, after you expose the mouse to the prion, it can take up to 2 years, sometimes 500 days or more, just to get the results from a single biological assay.
500 days for one result. Imagine trying to test thousands of potential drugs when each test takes 2 years.
Exactly, it's just not feasible.
That sounds like an agonizingly slow way to do science, especially when, you know, patients don't have years to wait. But what about those rapid diagnostic tests I've read about, like RTQIC? They seem to deliver results much faster.
They do, yeah. And they are brilliant tools for clinical diagnosis. So RTQIC stands for real-time quaking-induced conversion.
Ejecting.
Right. It uses a vigorous shaking to literally force the prion proteins to interact and clump together in a test tube. And then we use fluorescent dyes to measure that clumping. But there is a massive caveat here.
Okay, what is it?
Those assays measure the biochemical seeding activity of the protein. They do not measure actual complex biological infectivity.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. Let me look at it this way.
Wrong.
Screening drugs with RTQIC is kind of like testing a fire extinguisher on a photograph of a fire instead of actual flames.
Oh, that is a perfect analogy.
Right, because you might see the image distort or wash away, but you aren't measuring your ability to put out a real spreading inferno. You are measuring the real infectious agent.
That analogy holds up perfectly, yes. You are measuring a forced chemical reaction in a tube, not the incredibly intricate biology of a living, breathing cell actually taking in a pathogen, sustaining the replication, and slowly getting sick.
Which perfectly explains why so many supposed anti-prion drugs that looked like incredibly promising in those surrogate rapid tests ended up completely failing when they finally made it to human clinical trials.
Exactly. They were putting out the photograph, not the fire.
Wow. So the field desperately needed a dividing cell line that could sustainably replicate genuine infectious human SEJD prions.
They needed a system that could be grown infinitely, screened rapidly, and trusted to actually reflect human biology. And that is the monumental task this team set out to accomplish.
Well, let's get into the methodology then, because what they did here isn't just finding a cell that worked. They basically had to custom build a biological chimera.
They really did. So they started with a cell line known as CEFE5. These are mouse brain cells, catecholaminergic cells, to be precise. And in the prion research world, SAT5 cells are actually famous because they are exceptional at harboring and replicating non-human prions, like those from sheep or from other mice.
Wait, murine, meaning mouse-related. If we are trying to cure a human disease, why on earth are we starting with mouse brain cells?
I know, it seems completely counterintuitive, but the rationale is based on something called cellular cofactors.
Cellular cofactors, meaning what exactly?
Well, there are these hidden, unidentified molecules or internal environments within a cell that are absolutely required for prions to replicate. And whatever those secret ingredients are, standard human cell cultures seem to just lose them when they're grown in a lab.
Oh, interesting. but the mouse cells don't.
Right. SATR5 mouse cells retain them. So the researchers hypothesized that the SATR5 cells possess the optimal broad cellular machinery. They have the fully functioning factory. They just needed to be retooled to process human raw materials.
Got it. So the mouse cell is the factory building. But before they could start manufacturing the human protein, they had to clear out the old mouse assembly line. Right?
They did. If they simply added the human prion gene while the endogenous mouse prion proteins were still present, they would experience something called dominant negative inhibition.
Okay, think of it like trying to build a complex 3D puzzle, but someone keeps throwing in pieces from a completely different puzzle. The mouse proteins physically get in the way of the human proteins trying to misfold and lock together.
A very clear way to visualize it, yeah. So to prevent that interference, the team used RNA interference technology, specifically short hairpin RNA, to essentially send a stop order to the cell's genetic factory.
So they just shut down the mouse protein production.
Exactly. They silenced the mouse PRP expression, creating a knockdown cell line, which they named KDB3.
So now they have a blank slate. A functional mouse brain cell factory with the right environment, but zero prion proteins of its own.
Then they introduced the human blueprint. They reconstituted these blank slate cells with the human PRNP gene. And specifically, they utilized a human variant that codes for the amino acid valine at codon 129.
Codon 129.
Yes, and we will explore why that specific genetic address is so vital to the results a bit later.
Okay, we'll pin that. And they couldn't just drop the human gene in and hope for the best, right? They had to give it a, like, microscopic GPS tracker.
They did, yeah. To ensure the newly synthesized human prion protein actually trafficked correctly through the murine cell and anchored to the outer cell membrane where it needs to be, they attached a mouse signal peptide to the human sequence.
Wow. So they engineered a truly humanized murine cell.
Yes. But even with this brilliantly engineered chimera, it wasn't a guarantee they'd catch the infection. Because, as we mentioned earlier, we still don't know exactly what those magical cellular cofactors are.
Right, you're still working on the dark a bit, so they had to play the numbers game.
They faced a massive stochastic challenge. The cellular environment is probabilistic. It varies slightly from cell to cell, even within the same dish. Since they couldn't intentionally design the perfect environment, they used iterative single-cell cloning.
What does that look like in practice?
Well, they took their engineered cells, diluted the liquid culture down so drastically that they could isolate hundreds of individual single cells in separate wells, and grew them into isolated clonal colonies.
That sounds incredibly tedious.
Very. Then they exposed every single colony to human SCJD brain homogenate to see which ones would propagate the disease.
It's less like engineering a specific machine and more like planting hundreds of seeds in slightly different soils, just waiting to see which one magically sprouts the exact plant you need.
That's a great way to put it. And out of all those colonies, they found one that sprouted, clone 81F9.
Okay, so they found one.
Yes. It reproducibly propagated modest amounts of the disease-associated misfolded protein, but the levels were too low for a robust assay, so they didn't stop. They took 81F9 and subjected it to the single-cell cloning process again and again.
So they were effectively directing the evolution of the cells toward higher and higher susceptibility.
Exactly. Iterative evolution in a dish. Taking the strongest performers and breeding them, essentially. And that extensive process led them to the fourth generation subclone, which they named.
I remember the numbers being pretty crazy, like EKV accumulated 5 to 14 times more of the misfolded PRPSC protein than that earlier 81F9 generation.
Yes, the directed enrichment worked beautifully.
The numbers are definitely impressive.
Yeah.
But, you know, how do we know they didn't just engineer a cell that naturally pumps out inert, harmless protein clumps? Like, how do we know this EKV cell is producing truly infectious, lethal prions?
That is the big question. And this brings us to the most critical validation in the entire study. To prove they had captured genuine infectivity, they had to perform the gold standard in vivo validation.
Okay.
They took the lysates, basically the disrupted, broken open contents of their infected EKV cells. And crucially, they did this after passing the cells through multiple generations to guarantee absolutely none of the original human brain tissue from the initial exposure was left.
So it's purely the lab-grown prions at this point.
Exactly. Then they injected those cell lysates directly into the brains of humanized TG152 2C mice.
Okay, and what happened to the mice?
100% of the mice injected with the cell lysate developed terminal prion disease.
Wow, every single one. So it definitely wasn't an anomaly.
The consistency was absolute, and the details of how the disease manifested are really what confirmed the success. The mean incubation period was 251 days.
Right.
And when the researchers examined the neuropathology under a microscope, looking at the actual tissue structure of the mouse brains, they found widespread spongiosis.
Spongiosis, meaning the brain tissue is literally riddled with microscopic holes, making it look like a sponge due to massive cell death.
Yes, exactly. In addition to that vacuolation, they observed dense synaptic prion protein deposition, intensely clustered in the thalamus and midbrain regions.
And that specific pattern means something.
It means everything. The specific anatomical pattern of the brain damage and the biochemical signature of the proteins extracted from those mice was functionally indistinguishable from a control group of mice that had been injected with actual raw human SEJD brain tissue.
Oh, wow. So the prions grown in a plastic dish and the prions pulled directly from a human brain act exactly the same in a living organism.
Precisely. They captured the true disease.
That is just phenomenal.
It is. And once they validated that the EKV cells were churning out genuine infectious prions, they immediately scaled the technology. They adapted the cells into a 96-well format, creating what they termed the human prion assay, or HPA.
A 96-well plate. Instead of managing a massive room full of mice, feeding them, monitoring them for a year and a half, you have a little plastic tray you can hold in one hand, running 96 separate experiments simultaneously.
The sheer efficiency is mind-blowing.
I mean, the sensitivity is equally staggering. The team demonstrated that the HPA could successfully detect SCJD prions from crude human brain homogenates, even when the sample was diluted 100,000-fold.
Yeah, that is finding a microscopic needle in a biological haystack.
So how did the math stack up when they pitted this new plate against the old animal models, like side by side?
They ran a side by side endpoint titration. They used the exact same sample and calculated the infectious titer using both methods. The gold standard mouse bioassay calculated a titer of 5.88 log units.
Okay.
The new EKV human prion assay calculated 5.66 log units.
Wait, they practically mirror each other.
Yeah.
But one takes a fraction of the time and resources.
Exactly. The mouse bioassay required dozens of animals and took roughly 500 days to reach that conclusion. The human prion assay delivered the exact same quantitative measurement in a matter of weeks.
That is a total paradigm shift for the pace of neurodegenerative science.
Plus,
and I mean, this isn't just about detecting the protein faster. It's about finding a cure. Were they able to use this to test any actual treatments?
Yes, to demonstrate the platform's viability for drug screening, they developed persistently infected lines designated as IEKV. These were cells that maintained a stable, vigorous prion infection over 15 continuous passages.
Wow, so they essentially engineered a renewable, endless source of live human prion infection that they could tap into at any time.
An infinitely renewable target.
So they have the disease locked in a dish. Did they try curing it?
They did. They treated these persistently infected IEKV cells with a known anti-prion antibody called ICSM-18, and the treatment was a complete success. The established infection was cured, and the cells ceased producing the rogue PRPSC proteins.
Which confirms the ultimate goal of the platform.
Okay.
You can establish the disease in these 96 wells and then systematically drop thousands of different pharmaceutical compounds into those wells to see which one clears the infection.
Exactly. It replaces unreliable surrogate testing with high-throughput, genuine biological infectivity testing. We can finally evaluate experimental therapeutics against the real human pathogen at scale.
That promises to drastically accelerate the drug discovery pipeline for SCJD.
It's a phenomenal leap forward.
But, you know, biology is notoriously messy, and cutting-edge models rarely come without caveats. What are the limitations here? Where does this new platform fall short?
Well, the authors are commendably transparent about the model's current limitations. The most prominent is what the field refers to as the mismatch issue.
Ah, okay. What does that mean?
Well, earlier we noted that the human PRNP gene they inserted into the EKV cells specifically coded for the amino acid valine at codon 129.
Right. The genetic address. Every human inherits two copies of this gene, one from each parent.
Exactly. At codon 129, a person can inherit either methionine or valine. If you have two valines, your genotype is VV. If you have two methionines, you are M.
Okay, I'm following.
Because the EKV cells were engineered with valine, they are functionally VV. The researchers found that while these cells enthusiastically replicated prions from ETC-JD patients who were also VV, or even heterozygous MV, they struggled significantly with the others.
Meaning they did not efficiently replicate prions from patients who were methionine homozygous, or MM.
Correct.
Let me make sure I'm fully grasping this. Even though the prion protein is fundamentally the same overall structure, just one tiny amino acid difference at a single location means the cell won't catch the infection.
It perfectly illustrates one of the most fascinating biological truths about prion strains. A prion strain doesn't just exist as one rigid shape. It exists as a cloud of slightly different conformations.
Oh, wow.
And the host cell's genetic makeup, whether it provides methionine or valine at that exact spot, acts as a lock. The prion shape is the key.
I see.
If the key from the MM patient doesn't fit the VV lock of the cell, that specific cloud of rogue shapes cannot take hold and replicate.
So it's a feature of the biology, not a failure of the assay.
Mm-hmm.
It proves just how agonizingly specific these protein interactions are.
Precisely.
Though it does mean the team will likely need to engineer a complementary MM version of these cells so they can screen drugs for all types of patients.
Oh, absolutely. And the team acknowledges that exact necessity. They're already working toward complementary cell lines to bridge that gap. But there was one other vital nuance the study uncovered regarding occult or hidden infectivity.
Hidden infectivity. Where was it hiding?
Remember the KDD3 cells? The blank slate mouse cells where they had deleted the mouse prion protein but before they added the human gene?
Right, the functional factory with no raw materials. They shouldn't be able to misfold anything.
As a stringent control measure, the researchers exposed those blank slate cells to infectious human prions. They then passaged the cells 6 times.
Meaning they let the cells divide, wash them, move them to a new dish, and repeated this 6 times to dilute and wash away any of the initial brain sample.
Exactly. Then they injected those cells into a mouse. And astonishingly, one of those mice developed terminal prion disease.
Wait, if the blank slate cells couldn't replicate the prion, how on earth did the mouse get sick?
It indicates that a microscopic residual amount of the original infectious human brain homogenate physically clung to the cells or the plastic dish.
You're kidding.
Nope. It didn't replicate because the cells lacked the protein to do so, but the original prion survived through 6 rounds of division and transfer.
That's just, it's terrifyingly resilient.
It highlights the extreme resilience of these proteins, and it serves as a stark warning to researchers. Future drug assays will require extended passaging and rigorous controls to guarantee we are measuring newly generated prions rather than just stubborn leftovers from the initial exposure.
Wow. So when we step back and view the entirety of this research, what's the ultimate takeaway here?
By iteratively engineering and blindly selecting highly susceptible dividing cells, this team has established a robust, scalable platform capable of propagating authentic human SCJD prions. This breakthrough bridges a decades-long translational gap in neurology. It transforms an agonizingly slow, animal-dependent testing process into a rapid, precise, cell-based assay.
Which is the exact toolset required to turn biological mysteries into curable diseases. But, you know, this leaves you with something entirely new to ponder. We've just discussed how this platform relies on matching the exact genetic lock and key of the prion strain to the cell. If we can engineer cells this precisely, could we one day see a world of truly personalized medicine? A future where a patient's own skin cells were taken, reprogrammed into brain cells, and dropped into these 96 well plates to find a bespoke, customized cure tailored exclusively to the unique misfolded proteins in their specific brain. The possibilities for tailored therapeutics are just staggering. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base. Turning everywhere, not a fever, not a bruise, but a hidden spark.
In the dark.